We got a spike in Patreon subscribers because everyone wanted to hear part two of what you said. And then someone basically was telling me, like, you should just give the podcast to her. Oh, thanks, guys. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
They're like, I learned a lot from her. Maybe she should be more on more. And someone was like, maybe she should just host it. I'm like, oh, thank you. Thank you. Very
well,
nice.
I'm very, very honored. And of course, I'll be glad to take over your podcast. No, I mean, come on more often as a guest.
I think they really, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people, I'm not exactly sure what they were responding to. Maybe it's more just like I think it was your ability to have multiple viewpoints. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, but can't articulate it as well as you do in terms of like how you can see things from different perspectives and sort of change your mind as time goes on. And I've noticed online, it's sort of with your Twitter and stuff, it's been sort of like, you know, what we talked about more. It's like things are really seem to be changing mm-hmm. in terms of your viewpoint. And I think it seems to be part of a larger shift in awareness or consciousness that's going on, particularly in Taiwan. I don't know if that's true, but that's what it seems to be.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I mentioned last time about popcorn theory yet, did I?
Popcorn theory. No, I don't think so.
Okay, so just imagine that you have this pot of popcorn. You added some oil. You set the heat up to medium high, and for the longest time, it just seems like nothing's happening. You take a peek, nothing is happening. You go away, you come back, you hear one pop, one corn popping. Still looks like nothing's happening. You could wait quite a while before the second corn pops.
Okay, I know I see where you're going with this. And then suddenly, you know, then very quickly, right? Like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think what caught everybody else by surprise about me changing my view is I was a very early popcorn, just awkwardly hanging out in a pan where it seems like nothing was happening. Mm. But in fact, I live in Taiwan. I watch the same crazy political shows as everybody else. I have the same conversations. I get bothered by the recall groups on street corners, just like everybody else. And the best way I can describe it is just like this pressure builds inside until one day you just pop. And okay. I think the reason why I felt so isolated is, first of all, yeah, I did kind of pop kind of early. I think part of it is to do with the fact that I can see both sides of the equation. So I see the think tank pieces from America saying basically how they're going to set us up with drones in case of a Chinese attack, which, you know, is really enraging. It's like, yeah. What? Seventh Fleet isn't going to do anything? Come on.
Yeah, they're going to give you like modified, you know, Meta Oculus VR goggles and say, get to work. And then,
Android drones at 1 million USD a pop. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, come on. Yeah.
So I think I popped early because I was simultaneously very aware of the US discourse and under like the true pressure in Taiwan. Like I can't overemphasize the degree which the Great Recall campaign really cranked up the partisanship to a boiling point. Because, you know, we just had our legislative elections in 2024.
These are the recall efforts to try and get like KMT legislators recalled and all that stuff.
Absolutely. They were... Mm-hmm. I call them the sore loser recalls because the recall mechanism is there for when a particular person really commits some acts of malfeasance or does something that is so contrary to voter expectations that there is a mechanism for removing them before their term is up. Otherwise, you elect somebody in a democracy. That's the people saying, we want this person to serve out their term, right? So what is the justification for the DPP to say, oh, we're actually going to launch a mass recall of every single KMT legislator we can? And there is basically no legitimacy, apart from they want to get the legislature back. They couldn't stand being in the minority in the legislature. But that's not a very good slogan. So instead, they went back to the well. They went back to playing the resist China and protect Taiwan card. And that meant keep cranking up that partisan pressure. And I think it caused a lot of people to lose it.
You know, it's nice to see for me, because I realized it was kind of depressing in a certain way to have my specific set of, like, say, political orientations and sort of have to dismiss Taiwan as kind of a lost case. It's like self-colonizing, kind of like picking the wrong side on every, you know, future trend. Didn't look like it would have much of a future. It just seemed kind of sad because it's a waste. And this sudden turnaround, I think, you know, you were describing, I mean, I'm not there, so I don't know exactly what is going on, but kind of what you're telling me and what some of my other friends in Taiwan are telling me, and then this whole saga with Jim Boss, which is fascinating. You know, it suddenly changes my perception of Taiwan's future as rather bright, potentially bright.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, yeah. Here's the interesting thing, right? Everybody thought that the recall elections was going to be rather successful. Even the people who were anti-recall all the way, even the KMT internally predicted that they were probably going to snipe maybe 6 or 7 legislators.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to be such a complete shutout, such a complete repudiation, meant that there's a whole bunch of silent majority people who just weren't revealing their preferences because they prefer not to be judged. But
I'm sorry. So to make sense of your story, is this up for like a referendum vote? Is that how that works? Or was this a legislative vote?
Rewind a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in Taiwan, you can recall legislators or mayors ahead of their term if you collect enough petitions from their constituency.
Okay, so there is like a referendum aspect. You have to go directly to the people.
So basically, step one is you collect enough petitions.
Right.
And then step two, there is a recall election. And then you have to have, obviously, to be successfully recalled, you have to have more recall votes than anti-recall votes. And you also have to have at least 25% of the turnout.
I see. Okay.
So we were really pessimistic on these recall votes because the DPP and their affiliate groups, they're kind of playing it off like it's a grassroots effort, but we all know it's coordinated. They were spectacularly successful in the petition collection phase.
Mm.
So they were very organized, they very coordinated, and they managed to like gather enough petition signatures to recall 31 legislators.
Wow.
And the KMT...
All KMT or all opposition?
KMT. And of course, the KMT also tried to counter recall like DPP legislators, but they had no success. They were not even able to gather enough signature petitions for a single one. So that's why all the legislators up for recall were DPP, and people took it as a huge signal that there was a lot of support behind the recalls. And Everywhere you went in Taiwan for the last almost a year, there were visible signs of recall support. They had rallies. They were set up on street corners. It could be one guy holding up a sign. It could be a whole group of them, like trying to talk to you, buttonhole you, tell you about how evil the KMT are and how they're going to give away Taiwan to China, and how once it's sold out, there's no coming back from it. There's even people saying like really, truly crazy shit like, yeah, the men are going to be sent to Ukraine to fight and the women are going to be organ harvested. And it's just like really ridiculous depth of the Cold War Red Scare shit, right? And online too, it was all that. And it was, let me tell you, a very depressing time to be a pro-TPP or pro-KMT person. But I think that kind of created a silent force. And then when the votes came out, and turns out actually, no, we were the majority. We are actually, they were the minority. They were the ones that should be marginalized and was annoying everybody. And then that's how the it just turned upside down. And Threads, which is the social media platform that for some reason the Taiwanese are on, if they are like too young for Facebook, it used to be like 90% pro DPP, and all of a sudden it just flipped over. And a lot of DPP accounts are like, oh my God, it's a coordinated attack by the Chinese. They've unleashed the bot farms. How else am I getting like all these like anti-DPP responses I wasn't getting before? And that of course makes no sense. If the CCP wanted to do a coordinated bot attack, they would have done it before the recall elections, not after.
Yeah.
But what it actually is a lot of people who felt like they had to be silent because they felt like they were very alone in their point of view, suddenly realized they were actually in the majority and they felt liberated and loud, and they had some grievances, and they were, it was kind of like a sudden turning of the tides. And it's also a reminder of Taiwan being an island community. And I do think there's island community mentality, which is you kind of hide your thoughts on the matter a little bit more carefully.
Right.
You're in close proximity with everybody, right?
Sure.
You don't want
to take the risk of like, you know, being subversive. And everyone's like, whoa, 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 what are you talking? You know, even people who are secretly in their heart, like on your side, may be performative and saying like, whoa, 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 you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like maybe the way to think about it is the Overton window being very tight, because everybody's cheek by jowl on this island, right? It's a lot of people and everybody knows everybody. So you really don't want to mess up your networks by saying something that's considered over the line. So like one way somebody described it to me, it's really, really funny. He said, Angelica, we are basically in the middle of InfoWars on both sides. And if it's an active battlefield, never reveal your true location. So, people are, you know, gotten very good at sort of, you know, putting politics in a different bucket and saving it for within their private line groups where they know they're all within people of their who think the same. Then they can, you know, let rip and be a bit more open. But I think also it's how the pro-recall groups got caught. They got caught in their own bubble, or in Chinese, in Taiwan here, we say tongwenchen, the same layer of groupthink layer,
mm-hmm.
that just got thicker and thicker as they, you know, I went to one of those rallies just as a tourist, and, you know, I didn't, you know.
A DPP rally?
One of the pro-recall rallies, yes. So yeah. They were all DPP. And it was quite honestly almost a little bit of a cult-like atmosphere.
Right.
Like, yeah. People were like cheering anytime they got a petition sign up, or people were like crying as they were listening to music, you know. And I was asking a couple of them, like, you know, so are you guys what, ultimately pro Taiwan independence? And they're just like, yeah, you know, when the time is right, yeah, of course we're pro Taiwan independence. I was like, that's actually not the DPP official stance. They're just like, well, yeah, that's what, just what we say for now. But quite honestly, in the future, there's no true sovereignty without Taiwanese independence. And then I was just like, well, you know, do you think that the U.S. is a reliable partner in supporting that independence struggle right now? And they were just like, and I was blown away by this. They were dead ass saying, when it comes to sovereignty, we hope we can have the help of our allies, but we don't rely on anybody else. We are ready to defend Taiwan. And I don't know, like, what you think about that, but to me, that's like insane.
It's insane, but it's surprising to me because it sounds like they are sensitive about saying that they do trust America. They know, is it like, I mean, because that seems to be a big change too, right? To have an awareness to say, like, I'm not going to go all the way out and say I totally trust the United States.
Well, that is a big shift, actually. And probably, you know, to go back to the popcorn analogy, Trump coming into office was basically somebody turning the heat up from a medium low to high in terms of building that pressure. Because, remember, like, before Trump, during the Biden years, the big DPP talking point was warning people against Yi Mei Lun, which is supposed to be a horrible conspiracy theory. And it literally just means the theory of doubting America.
Yeah.
And so basically, if you are questioning anything about, well, why is the U.S. reducing their troop presence on Guam, or, you know, anything that could possibly indicate that you're wondering about whether or not you trust America 100% is actually being treasonous,
right, and
falling into Chinese talking points and being defeatist and being a non-thinking conspiracy theorist. And that was the line that they were pushing. It was already ridiculous at the time, and I would call it out, but I think I was very, very early on that. That was a line that was pushed on everybody, but it really became untenable as soon as Trump came into office.
Right. Interesting.
Because we just got screwed over and over again, stabbed in the back over and over again. And the Taiwanese, I think, are very sensitive to business news, finance news.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us, whether or not we work in tech, a lot of people are involved somehow in manufacturing or exporting or stuff like that. We certainly have stocks.
I mean, it's very much Taiwan Inc. to an extent, right?
Like, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're all like deeply, deeply aware of the importance of TSMC,
mm-hmm.
what it means for Taiwan geopolitically, technologically, economically. And it was promised to us over and over again during the Biden years. Like, Yeah, you come to, we want to encourage you to come to Arizona and build your plant. But we will also promise you that the most advanced node will always stay in Taiwan. That was a guarantee again and again. Don't worry, they're not taking our technology, because even though we're building a plant over there, the most advanced node will always stay in Taiwan. And that was repeated again and again and again, almost like a mantra, like the most advanced node will always stay in Taiwan. So you don't have to worry about...
Well, if the American president says it over and over, you got to think at some level. I mean, I'm not making fun of people who think this way. I think if the American president says it over and over again, at some level, you're going to be kind of reassured. You're going to be, well, he said it a lot of times, you know, and you want it to be true, and you want to have a meeting, you want to have a meeting of the minds, right? You don't want to think of someone as a liar.
And also, you remember how fruitful and how Taiwan has benefited over the decades from our relationship with America, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So from the kids post-war who got a lot of their nutrition from the powdered milk sent by USAID, to the fact that we got TSMC at all, we understand on some level that's because we are America's good little brother in the region. And so I think the KMT, at least, the KMTers, the older generation, they understand that it is a part of a deal. Whereas I think maybe the DPPers tend to be more taken in by the like-minded democracy talk. But I think most Taiwanese recognize on some level it is a deal. And they know that we benefited from that deal. And the United States built up a lot of trust with the Taiwanese over time. But you also know what they say, that trust is gained in drops and lost in buckets. And when Trump came in and he reneged on and insisted that the most advanced node need to move to the United States, that crossed the red line for a lot of people.
Hmm.
And it's even worse than that. He even said, this isn't Trump. It's his deputy. Is it Lutnick or the other guy? No, the other guy, Besant. No, Lutnick. Howard Lutnick. He said, oh, by the way, that Biden era CHIPS Act money we promised you, we're not just going to give it to you free and clear. No, 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 no. We will be expecting TSMC stock for that money.
Was it this recent that they said that?
Very recent.
Yeah, they have this new thing. They want the government suddenly wants to take, the U.S. government wants to take ownership positions in Intel and in NVIDIA and now TSMC. They want like direct ownership of these semiconductor companies. It's really quite bizarre what's going on. We've never heard of it, but yeah.
The whole Trump administration has just been so off script. And I think that people are realizing that they're not going to stop unless they get a pushback. They're just always going to keep asking for one more bite at the apple until you're strong enough to say no. And don't think the Taiwanese haven't noticed the Chinese standing up to America and being insulated from Trump's depredations, because they actually prepared for it and they have a strong enough economy to weather it and they're diversified enough to survive it. So it's actually a huge wake-up call that America, which is supposed to be our ally, is actually treating us worse because we trusted them and we didn't set up these protections against them and we didn't have our guard up against them.
Yeah, I think I was always curious, especially around the time of this current of the 2024 election, when, if I don't know if you know, remember Vivek, Vivek Ramaswamy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And all the crazy shit he said, because he fashioned himself sort of like a tech adjacent, you know, mm-hmm. Indian bro guy, you know, and mm-hmm. so he carried himself with a certain amount of tech swagger.
Yep.
And he said, look, if I'm because he ran for president, and he goes, if I'm president, this is my Taiwan policy. It was so strange. He was so clear about it. He was like, I'm going to offer them. I'm going to continue the security guarantee for another 3 years. And in that 3 years, we are going to take every single chip manufacturing asset out of Taiwan, and then we're going to put it in America. And when that process is done, we're going to stop the security guarantee comes to an end, because that's America's interest in Taiwan, and that's all I care about. And he said it with such directness, and it landed pretty well. I think most Americans were like, yeah, makes sense to me. Trump went with it. He was like, you know, no one really pushed back on that in the United States. You know, did that make its way to Taiwan, and did people have a reaction to what he was saying?
Well, Vivek's stuff didn't make it back to Taiwan, but I heard it. So that's probably another reason why I think I kicked the other side, kicked over to the other side sooner. But I heard it, and damn, makes sense to me as from an American point of view. Mm-hmm. And I think Taiwan got the message when they saw it through Trump's actions. And yeah. I think when he very, very, very first came in, it was like, okay, Trump is transactional. How do we appease him by being transactional and flatter him and, you know, offer him to buy more U.S. weapons, blah, blah, blah. But very quickly, it escalated very quickly. And then people were like, oh, no, there's no bargaining with this guy. The bargaining phase is over because he's just going to take whatever he can. And I think people were also quite disgusted by President Lai's performance and the general trade negotiation team, because there's a sense that Taiwan still had some good cards to play, right?
Sure, of course.
We literally are the world's only producer of these super powerful chips that everybody needs to make their sand god supercomputer or whatnot, right? We control it. We literally do. And, you know, that is literally something we could have used to make a better deal for ourselves.
Of course. I mean, if you were viewing this chips issue from the United States perspective, I mean, we meaning like, you know, political leaders, people in the media, tech people, were like looking at this as an economically existential issue. Mm-hmm. If we lost access to Taiwan's output because the Chinese, you know, in our paranoid mind, because, you know, we work in a paranoid mode. If the Chinese were to suddenly ambush Taiwan and take it, you know, our generals were like, well, we can't really stop it, to be honest. And then the economics guys were like, well, then our chips are, you know, our supply chain is just totally cut. And then the tech guys are like, and then that's like total disaster. Our, you know, the economy is going to collapse. So, yeah, I mean, if you could see the cards from the other side, I think you're right. It wasn't. Taiwan had a good hand, and it still has a good hand, and the United States has a very poor hand when it comes to this particular issue, which may be part of the reason why, I don't know, there's a lot of, I mean, I think there's without doubt, I mean, that should go without saying, there's an incredible amount of, like, CIA activity in Taiwan, and I'm sure there's tons of meddling in the election. It would be strange if there wasn't, given our MO. Right. I think we should start from the assumption that there is and be surprised if there isn't. And so, yeah, sorry, I'm just aside because I think you're absolutely right. I think Taiwan has a very strong hand.
Well, so. Here's the thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I really hate the overuse of the word agency, because it's generally used that in the way of, you cannot take away the agency of the Taiwanese people to demand democracy and freedom and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's very...
I think I know who you're talking... You know, I get the crowd. Yeah, I get it.
But I actually think it's very apropos to use here. Mm-hmm. The Taiwanese hated the DPP, hated the administration for not using their agency.
Right.
They had the cards, they had leverage, and it was discovered that they cannot use any of this leverage because they are in some way just so completely in the United States pockets.
That makes me really optimistic for you to say that, because, you know, it would be super depressing if the people weren't angry and were like, yeah, good, we hope you really succeed in flattering Trump. You know, like the fact that there's still anger in the people and a belief among the people that Taiwan should have a more prominent role in these, in not just this negotiation, but in world affairs, that there's still, you know, a bit of that fighting spirit in Taiwan that it exhibited for most of the, you know, latter half of the 20th century, still there, maybe? I don't know.
We're pragmatic people. And, you know, we're Taiwanese. We're happy to be Taiwanese, Chinese. We can change around the labels, whatever. But you mess with our money.
Yeah.
And something really, really primal happens, I think, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think Trump messed with our money. And we were not having that. And I mean, in a way, it almost sounds kind of silly, right? Because we were talking about like really highfalutin themes, from sovereignty to self-determination to heritage to belonging, history, like all these like big topics. And when it comes down to it, it's like, oh no, you said you weren't going to do that and you did. And we're not having it. Maybe it's as simple as that. But I think obviously, like, I'm being a little bit facetious there, but if somebody is shaking you down for protection money, you can pretty much assume he's not really going to protect you, right?
Also, these things, you know, these values of sovereignty and of, you know, whatever other higher order values there are, it needs to be built on top of, like, economic security. Like, it needs to be built on top of prosperity and wealth.
Or, and, you know, you can turn it around. What sovereignty do you really have? You can't even prevent your closest ally from chivvying off your industrial crown jewel.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Where's your sovereignty? What sovereignty is there?
Do you wonder about... Because, like, when you said that, I feel like an American or like a Westerner would find that statement to be a little bit like betraying a certain crudeness to Chinese or to Taiwanese about how important money is. But, like, I don't know. For me, I feel like is that maybe a lesson that was learned maybe by a lot of Chinese and Asians generally, but, like, I'll say for Chinese, that the poverty of the 20th century and the sudden turn towards just being poor, like, in as a historical experience, is informing that to be like, wait, let's get the priority straight here. You could talk all you want about your values and your political ideals, but if you're dirt poor, forget it. You know, I always wonder if that's part of this stereotype, which I actually find to be true. The comedian, like, Ronnie Cheng makes fun of this in a positive way, I'd say.
It's funny because it's true, right?
It is true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a sense in that if you mess with other people's money, you've crossed a really, really unforgivable line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's there in a lot of cultures, but I think it's very primal in the Chinese psyche. You said you got to secure that bag first, and then you get to do fun stuff. And then maybe your kids can, maybe your grandkids can be a comedian, right? And laugh about it. But first you have to secure the bag. And I think in Taiwan, that also drives a lot of our attitude towards China, frankly. I think a lot of the anti-Chinese antipathy is down to the fact that they were poor. And we looked down on them because they were poor. And now we look at them and we're like, oh, shit, we're poor. I mean, okay, average GDP per capita, we're still richer by a substantial amount. But you go to, like yesterday, like I had a friend come in. He was visiting Taipei for the first time. And I was asking him, so what do you think of Taipei? And he said, well, I just came from Shanghai, so it feels poor. Tough but fair. But then he added, oh, but it also feels very free. You can really feel the freedom.
Okay, yeah, that's all right. All right. Zip it.
So it's like, okay, yeah. We can be all right, dude. Poor for free. But I think people kind of know the deal now. Like, yeah, there's certainly rural parts of China that we're far, far wealthier than, but then there are also parts of China that we're no longer as wealthy as. Mm. And we no longer feel like when we look up to China, we no longer just feel like fear and loathing that they're like this big bully wanting to take us over. It's also like, yeah, respect. You guys kind of made it. It's kind of all a part of the mix. And don't forget, Taiwan has been really unhealthy economically in the last few decades. And a lot of people are surprised when I say that because our GDP is still growing and everybody hears about TSMC. Mm-hmm. So they think that we're this like, you know, super advanced tech island. But I cannot underestimate how unbalanced it makes the economy when you have one company that is responsible for so much of the growth. Sure. And it's not employing like 10% of the population, right? But it's taking 10% of the electricity. And if you take away TSMC, Taiwanese grows so anemic. And you take away the tech, then it's like going backwards. So people are really feeling the pinch because average wage has been stagnant for, I think, at least, I would say maybe the last 2 to 3 decades now. It hasn't been rising like it was in the 80s and the 90s. So your pay doesn't go up, but guess what goes up every year? Real estate goes up every year. So if you didn't get on the housing ladder, you were completely screwed. Or if you're young, right? You couldn't have bought the house back in the 80s because you were born in 2000, right? So
what's your, I'm sure you're aware of this, but like what was your awareness level of how that basically describes the United States?
You know what? I think my awareness level is pretty high because
You lived here.
Well, right? I lived there, so I've seen it. The same story happen, and in fact, I wrote a post on Typology called "The Story of Three Housing Bubbles," and it compared the housing bubble in Japan versus the United States versus China, and I actually think I gained a lot of respect for China for taking on a massive speculative property asset bubble at a time and manner of its own choosing. Now, the last chapter hasn't been written yet, so we can't say for sure, we can't issue a final score yet, but that has never happened before. And when you look at how the Japanese bubble basically when it popped, it or deflated slowly over time, it basically put the Japanese economy in zombie mode for decades, arguably never recovered. And if you look at the U.S. property bubble, and when that burst, the U.S. basically like exported its mess, right? It was, it's kind of, actually kind of ironic how Europe never returned to its post great financial crisis rate of growth, but America.
Yeah, well, we crashed rates. We destroyed the value of, you know,
exactly.
foreign countries' reserves for our own benefit.
And when you analyze those two cases and you look at what China did instead, which I'm going to summarize it very concisely, basically, they saw the property bubble coming, they prepared for it, and then they did a massive deleveraging where none of the real estate companies were bailed out. Individuals were kind of bailed out by having the mortgage of their first home restructured to be affordable. And then they turned on the credit spigot full bore to go into tech and manufacturing. So they had cheap credit flowing for basically manufacturing investments. And this allowed them to kind of maintain their GDP. So basically all that GDP loss from the housing crash and crash in consumer confidence was kind of made up for by the manufacturing investment. So if you were like more of a China skeptic, if you were an economist like Brad Setzer or Michael Pettis, you would say, oh, they didn't solve the property bubble. They just deflated the property bubble and replaced it with a manufacturing bubble. And now you have overproduction. And that is a problem that they haven't solved yet. And
why does Beida still employ that guy? It's so crazy.
I don't know.
It's crazy. I think this guy has a humiliation fetish. You know, like, I think he just likes being dunked on mercilessly. But anyway, go on.
But yeah,
like, such an idiot.
So basically, okay, let's take Michael Pettis at his word. China did replace a housing bubble with a manufacturing bubble. Well, good, because we know that tech goes through these cycles of bubbles and crashes all the time, and generally when it's different when a
primarily a stock market phenomenon.
Yeah. But basically all that tech investment, you're left with something, right? And that becomes a foundation, like all that what looks like detritus in the aftermath of a bubble popping actually becomes kind of the fuel and the ingredient for the next phase of growth. So if you look at China and all the technologies that it's actually world beating in, and how it's still like touching the edges of robotics, and trying to keep up with AI, that is a very legitimate recipient of investment. I don't think it's malinvestment. Whereas I think if the housing bubble just kept going up and up and up, then it is a waste. And when it pops, that damage is both harder to recover from and you're not really left with anything.
Yeah. And it, you know, with, by the way, what is Typology for everyone's benefit? Because that sounds interesting.
Oh, sure.
Is that a Substack?
It's my Substack. And
oh, right.
I started, it's spelled T-A-I-P-O-L-O-G-Y. Mm-hmm. And it's super fun because I started it in 2020. So you can scroll back and enjoy the retardation of my Taiwan fangirl, PPP, Rainbow Boba phase. And, it's interesting because I feel like I stand by the quality of those pieces, but you can really tell they were written from a very different point of view.
Yeah, you know, okay, so let's that's interesting. Let's talk about that for a sec. Cuz I've never seen anyone do this actually. I was thinking about that. I've never seen anyone actually do this. You showcase your own articles on, say, Twitter, and you're like, I can't believe I wrote this. you know, I've never seen anyone do that.
Malice, self-criticism really becomes
the closest I ever saw was, do you know, the New York Times, the former New York Times economics columnist, Paul Krugman?
Yeah.
He one time, he's famous because he wrote in a tweet once, he was like, a long time ago, or maybe this is pre-tweets, like this, he wrote in an article, he said, the internet's pretty good, but I think he said something like, you know,
it's only going to be as consequential as the fax machine.
As the fax machine, right? And then everyone made fun of him for decades for writing that. And then he finally got so sick of being trolled about it that he wrote a response article that said, yes, I was wrong. But but how wrong really was I? And he wrote this whole thing that said, okay, it's bigger than a fax machine, but it's nothing compared to agriculture.
my goodness.
Come on, dude. He's like, they make it out to seem bigger than agriculture, but I think agriculture was bigger. The Industrial Revolution was bigger. The formation of the Earth from the accretion of mere dust was a bigger economic event than the internet by a factor of at least 10.
Wow.
And he framed it that way. That you're really out on a limb because you're like, here's something that I wrote, and I wanted to ask you about it. Like, what is this article that you wrote that made you cringe at what you were saying before? And what's the what's the process of, what's it like to look at, because I'm too defensive to do that. If I would probably just secretly delete something that I don't, you know, I was like, oh, I didn't write that. What's the process here? What exactly did you write? And what was your reaction?
I used to be so like sentimentally pro DPP because I don't know if I told you the story last time, right? I came to Taiwan after COVID. So I felt really, really like I needed a connection to reconnect to Taiwan again, right? And sure. So felt very lost and stuff like that. So I was very sentimental about Taiwanese sovereignty, Taiwanese independence. It was kind of somewhat new to me because before I kind of ignored all that noise, right? The last time I lived in Taiwan was during the Ma years. Taiwan was a backwater. We weren't getting visits by those senators and whatever. And I just remember once, like, it was some Czech senator coming to visit Taiwan or ex whatever. Anyhow, he came to visit Taiwan, he gave this speech, and he talked about how it's just one struggle in the world, liberalism against authoritarianism, we're all joining hands, and the Czech Republic threw off the evil empire, and Taiwan will one day be, you know, and I was just like...
Liberal speechmaking, yeah, in the vein of a...
And I was just, like, so... moved in the moment by that. I was like doing that thing where you go through the thread and you like every reply. So crazy.
But it fit them. I mean, you're saying that it was hitting all the right buttons in terms of the sort of like,
yeah,
the situation that people like you found yourself in at that time. Like,
exactly.
A world that's like suddenly changed and, you know,
within COVID, I think it just made a lot of sense. Like Taiwan did a lot
and it looks like, and it looked back then, it looked back then that maybe China did, it might be China's fault that that world comes to an end.
Yeah. That too was definitely in the background. So, you know, it just all made a lot of sense at the time. And also I think, it was also like during the COVID time, there was so much uncertainty about China because it was like an information lockdown, right? Like we didn't know what was going on. It was a black box. So in the absence of actual information from there, it's just like a lot of fear, rumor, proliferation. I think during COVID was when I got most sucked in on the Uyghur genocide thing. You know, so I really like basically anything Adrian Zenz presented, I pretty much believed it wholesale. And, you know, it's in that atmosphere, what I wrote, I was very sincere, you know, and I, at that time, I just didn't doubt it. I think the reason why I'm able to confront it and not feel like too personally embarrassed. Okay, it's a little bit embarrassing. but
I think so.
I'm able to confront it because I feel like a lot of it I was just lied to. And another thing is, it happened too suddenly, right? I can't hide all the evidence. I can't delete it all. So I might as well exploit it for content.
Right. No, I think that's admirable. I think you and I at that time were having some very different reactions to this. I remember because I was in China right before COVID actually became a thing. And I traveled through Wuhan at the time.
Wow.
And sometimes I wonder if I'm patient zero because the very neighborhood that I live in, I don't know if I should say this on the pod, the very neighborhood that I live in became like ground zero for COVID in America.
Holy shit.
And the hospital right near me, Elmhurst Hospital, was the first one to create a COVID center and the internet. It was anyway, I was in China in 2019. And I don't know what happened, but like one night, and I was in my apartment. My wife has her family has an apartment there. I was there by myself. My wife went out to go visit some friends, and I just had this emotional sort of like thing where I was like, "Shit, something's fucked up is going to happen." And I didn't know. I'm not saying I predicted what was going to happen. I'm saying that I was so filled up with what I knew were just blatant lies about China and things I took personally because I wouldn't take it as personally these days because since then I've wrapped my head around the political machinations behind this. I understand the motivations that it's you know, like what really sucks is if you think that if only they knew the truth, you know, then you're like, wait, you know, but now you're like, wait, they know the truth. They're just lying. You know, it's okay. So, but I was so filled with a certain kind of dread and rage about the kind of lies that were being pushed around that time, 2018, 2019, especially with Trump ramping up the trade war. You know, the first round that, you know, the first round of that trade war that people probably forgot with China and the Sinophobic stuff that was happening even prior to COVID. I remember sitting in China, you know, feeling very grateful that my wife's family was being really nice to me and I was meeting all her friends and they're just super nice. And I was like, you know what? I just have really warm feelings about, I was in China. I was like, this is a great, really nice place. And then just that contrasted with all the like horrible fucking lies that were being said in America made me like, at that moment, I was like, something bad's going to fucking happen. And then when COVID hit, I was like, I remember someone wrote a rather touching post. She or he, I forgot whether it was a man or a woman, was like, I'm from Wuhan, right? And I have no idea how my hometown can continue to exist after this. They were like, you know, the whole world is going to blame my city as where this started. And, you know, it's just total despair for me because I love that place. And, you know, and I kind of understood what this person was saying. They probably felt it a lot deeper than me. But I was like, you know, I'm going to see my sort of like loyalties here just completely fucking ripped to shreds. And I'm going to have to figure out what to do with that. You know what I mean? It was kind of like not I'm just saying this to elevate the level of what the fuck was going on during COVID. I think it was pretty intense. And so I think hearing, you know, a comforting and familiar narrative about what this was really about freedom versus, you know, authoritarianism and whatever, you know, I could see myself being sucked into this idea that, hey, maybe it's for the better that the Chinese Communist Party like fails and loses its legitimacy over a plague that engulfs the earth, and you know, a liberal government comes up in its place finally, or you know, and resolve this, like, just please resolve it for me.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that was when Taiwan really came up in the consciousness of the international media as like the anti-China, right? The plucky democracy island that's standing up to China.
What China could be.
What yeah. China could be, mm-hmm. but China couldn't allow Taiwan to exist because we are showing the people of China they can be democratic just like us. Yep. So that was when Taiwan really rose in opposition to the big bad China narrative. And I think a lot of us here in Taiwan were kind of got a little bit in over our heads with that kind of attention, because I think we're used to thinking of ourselves like definitely during the backwater President Ma years, we were used to thinking of ourselves as, you know, the orphan of Asia, right? The always like trying to press our nose against the glass of all these international institutions we're not invited to be a part of. And yes, we'll make your toys, we'll make your chips, we'll make your machines, but we're not really a country. And so we're kind of really used to being ignored, shut out, kind of neglected, and not being very visible on the world stage. And all of a sudden, during the COVID years, I felt like everybody wanted to know more about Taiwan. Everybody was interested in how Taiwan was doing so well. And everybody was like walking around, even when there's COVID everywhere else. We're enjoying the nightlife in Taipei because there's no COVID on the island. You know, hint, yeah. It's an island. So everybody were super interested in Taiwan, and we did a lot of like diplomacy things that were kind of charming, like, you know, donating masks to Europe or stuff like that. So, and President Tsai was very, very good at that sort of thing. I have to give it to the woman. She is extremely good at playing up that image. And I think everybody in the Washington establishment, everybody in the international media, they loved her.
For good reason. I think she, like, just seeing her, like, her aura.
Aura. Like,
yeah. She would do well in Washington.
Yeah.
Like, if yeah. she, like, I could see her as, like Hua Chao in Washington, where I grew up, as a prominent member of, like, you know, the sort of Taiwanese diaspora in DC that, you know, like the Elaine Chao types, you know, that worked their way up.
It's not just the aura. She definitely has it. Yeah. I mean, that kind of diplomatic adroitness. And you can even see it in politics in Taiwan now, right? It's right now, the DPP is a complete shit show. And a lot of it's due to lies, lack of aura, lack of charm, lack of leadership.
He really doesn't have it.
He doesn't.
He just doesn't fucking have it, you know?
No. Yeah. And, you know, the DPP, before Tsai came in, was always like a nest of vipers when it comes to different factions attacking each other and, you know, kind of being extremely, extremely combative and lacking in unity. And she actually put in a system that sorted everybody out. Like, she would apportion like each faction with all the sort of bennies that she could dole out as president, right? They didn't have an incentive to fight. It's like, hey, you get the mayorship this time, and hey, you get this legislative seat, you get this funding, you get this. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
She was able to divide and unite instead of, you know, she was just able
to.
She
had that mind that could calculate
exactly
what to do. She would be the star of like a whole political miniseries where she was like, you know, the woman from the bridge or the Brown, whatever. I don't know if you ever watched that, but
I know what you mean though. Like she definitely had that like rare quality of being very like coolly calculating, but also understanding human nature very well.
She's just very DC. Like if you know, like she's really DC. She would know like how to navigate a bureaucratic cesspool, like Washington, where I think that's why she had quite some success here.
Well,
she just has that thing, and I think there are a few like there are the Taiwanese elite. I think that I've seen in Washington. Like she's of that ilk is what I'm trying to say. She's just got the political acumen, but in a bureaucratic sense, not like a, you know, not like a great leader, but like an effective sort of technocrat type.
Well,
I don't know if that's Taiwan's view of her, but that was the sort of my outside view.
Let me tell you a little anecdote from electoral past that I think really illustrates the difference between Tsai and Lai. People actually forget in 2018, Taiwan was actually overtaken with, they called it the Han fever. Han Kuo-yu was the most popular politician in Taiwan. Newly elected KMT mayor of Kaohsiung. Even Kaohsiung is like DPP city. It's like completely green. But somehow he had this charm. He had this like down-homeness and he connected with everyone. Funnily enough, he also talked a lot about money. He's just like, what should our relationship be with the mainland? We should make money together. That was very much his pitch. And he was very popular. And for a while, our girl Tsai looked like she was on her way out. Her polls were very, very, very low. And Lai Ching-de at the time decided he was going to do a palace coup. So
he's got the look of a guy in one of those court dramas, you know, where and the music always changes when he comes up to like a little conniving tune.
And so it was so sneaky the way he did it, because he waited until she was like on an overseas trip and then he launched his candidacy with a book. Right. And it was like, oh my goodness, you sneaky little MF, right?
Right.
But here's the thing. Mm-hmm. If you want to come at the queen, you best not miss. And
see, this is hard shit right here, you know?
She was obviously, she felt very betrayed, but she came back to win the primary. And this is what she did to him. She made him her vice president.
Right.
So that she could keep him close and completely impotent.
Mm. I think that was the Biden move with Kamala.
I don't know. I think didn't he just want a black woman?
Well, no, she called him a racist and a white supremacist on stage and he got major props and claps for it. And then he was like, "You want to be vice president?" And she's like, "Yeah, sure." And she just totally was like, he's the greatest champion of black women there ever was in history.
Well, you know, whatever. I feel like, oh my God, if only he picked up. Anyhow, I won't go into American politics now.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this, actually. I don't know what your timing is, but I figured we could.
We can go. I don't have a
heart. Episode like last time?
Yeah, bonus me.
All right, let's do it. So we're going to flip a little bit over to a topic that I originally proposed to you, which is talk a bit about America for a minute.
Yeah.
And because that's your other, you know, sort of identity. And And we'll do that in the bonus pod. So if you want to get access, go to patreon.com/planningmeg. All right.